Nobody told me there'd be days like these. John Lennon, 25 years on.
A New York police officer, James Moran, says just a couple of hours before the shooting, the gunman got Lennon's autograph.
He was kind of fat. He didn't look like a groupie or, you know, anything like that. He almost had a sort of sneer on his face. I mean, he was proud of what he had done, apparently. He scuffled with him getting into the police car. His head was held high. He had kind of a sort of a smile almost. One person that lives across the street said he had seen the guy there on the sidewalk like all week. Had just been kind of hanging around. I think he intended to kill John Lennon. I don't think it was a robbery or anything like that.
Dear Mr. Lennon, from information I received while using a Ouija board, I believe that there will be an attempt to assassinate you. The spirit that gave me this information was Brian Epstein. He said the attempt would be made in place of March 6th, 70, and Mr. Epstein also said that Paul McCartney was alive in London.
Do it, do it, do it, do it. And I fired at his back 5 steady shots. I thought by killing him, I would acquire his fame.
We were parked approximately 2 city blocks away at 72nd Street and Broadway when the call came over of shots fired at the Dakota residence. So it took us a matter of seconds to get up there. And as we pulled up at the scene, I saw a doorman who was dressed, you know, nicely. And saw a handyman who I thought might be the bad guy. And then I saw another fella dressed in a long black overcoat with a tie on and a white shirt. And a short, chubby fella. And who would look the least to be the person that you're suspecting. So I trained my gun mainly on the handyman who was dressed a little shabbily because that's his nature of his job. But then the doorman pointed in Mark Chapman's direction, and it was the fellow who you would suspect it least from. And then the doorman hollered out to me, "He just shot John Lennon."
Chapman was seen as a sick, pathetic individual. There was nothing but, I suppose, anger that someone who professed to be so taken with the Beatles and with John specifically would have this kind of depraved mind that would kill him. It just made no sense.
So we spun Chapman around, put handcuffs on him, and just made sure he didn't have a second gun. And what he was mumbling at that point, just don't let the crowd get to me, and there had really been no crowd at that point, you know. But I remember him saying words to that effect.
You know, there's always something that comes up year after year where he's up for parole, and I don't get a sense, I may be just speaking for myself, I don't get a sense that there's a tremendous amount of sympathy for him. Perhaps that's changed. I mean, it's 25 years, but I still... You know, I don't understand what drives a person to do that sort of thing.
I wasn't killing a real person. I killed an image. I killed an album cover. I don't expect them to forgive me. I'm not asking.
The investigation, the telephone calls that were coming in. We sat with Chapman for quite a while, all through the night, in fact, until around 9 in the morning. And then they took him down to court. The scary part of the whole thing was that he would be the least person looking at him that you would suspect would pull a gun out and combat, aim and fire 5 shots at you. And that's what he did with Lennon. He was very calm. He was apologetic in his approach. To my recollection, it showed no real dislike for Lennon, showed no dislike for anybody, apologized for the trouble he was causing us with all this. And I remember saying to him, I said, "Boy," I said, "you just threw your whole life away." I said, "There's no real rhyme or reason for what you've done." Because to my knowledge, he showed no dislike. He mentioned words to the effect that he had a little person inside of him and a big person. And on previous occasions when he contemplated doing something like this, the bigger person inside of him won out. But tonight, the little person inside of me won the battle.
We all been playing those.
I was raised by my auntie. My father and my mother split when I was about four. I spent some time with mother up till about four. Then my father split. He was a merchant seaman, you know, you can imagine, and it was 1940s, yes, in the war and all that. And he left, and I was brought up by an auntie.
As a brother, because of the age gap, he was had to take a bit more responsibility, I suppose is the best way to put it. I mean, as he got older, he babysat for us, and he would take us to the park and the pictures and play with us. And obviously, my sister is 3 years younger again, so 2 years, 8 months, if you want to be precise, younger again. So even if he had us in the garden or in the street playing, he would have been responsible for our falling over, crying, arguing, whatever we were doing, because he was that much older.
He was a fantastic character, and I loved him. I had a child by him, and the John Lennon that was not on stage was totally different than the John Lennon that was at home.
Like a lot of early relationships, that early past their relationship, Cynthia and John were, you know, absolutely together every day, welded together, they went to college together, they moved in together, and then when the success happened and the money was coming in and they went down to London, right when she thought everything was perfect, it all gets snatched away from her by this strange woman that she'd had a kind of feeling was maneuvering herself into his life. She was writing to him, she was sending him postcards, she was sending him samples of her work, and Cynthia was kind of aware that this woman was moving in on John. She went away to Italy for a holiday and came back, and bang, Yoko's in the house.
He was a star, but I mean, he was not limited to that. I think he transcended all that as well. Yeah, I think so, you know. He was a man of great complexity. I mean, he had a wide range of emotion and complex thoughts, you know. And he covered it all, let's put it that way.
You would have thought that being that he kind of would appear to have longed for this male character in his life, a father figure, that when his son came along, when Julian came along, that he would overcompensate for lack of his own father. But, you know, 5 years old, he's gone, he's off with Yoko and left Cynthia and Julian on their own.
Poor Cynthia, even when he was born, she was in a general ward to begin with, and when John came up, he had her shunted quickly in Sefton General to a side ward. And there were fans outside, and Cynthia was on her own then, you know. It was that sort of celebrity cult was a new thing, wasn't it? And no one really expected it.
I don't remember seeing him as a child. You know, it was the height of the Beatle thing, so I was working all the time. I never considered what it was doing to him. I didn't even count it. Yeah, the mother was at home. I was away. Like most guys at 24, 25, they're too intent on the career, really, you know?
With John being the man and being the earner as well, and being in a very strange Beatles business, meaning earning meant he was flying off and disappearing and being surrounded by the hangers-on and the necessary people that encompass groups like the Beatles, the Stones, and every other celebrity, I suppose, now, isn't it? He wasn't living a normal life, was he?
Everybody's talking, and no one says a word. Everybody's making love, and no one really cares. There's Nazis in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, and nothing going on. There's always something cooking, and nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
there's a place for us in movies. You just gotta lay around.